This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have a great show for you today. A little later, we're going to break down the recent developments in the Massachusetts governor race, and then we will speak with Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Caselius about the end of the school year. But first, there are some local moves in the world of criminal justice reform we want to talk about. This week, the Massachusetts Sheriff's Association announced that they would make the first 10 minutes of phone calls from county jails free every week and standardize the cost of each minute after to a maximum of 14 cents. Now, that comes after big news last week in Connecticut, when Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont signed a law making all calls free for prisoners and their families, became the first state in the country to do so. There is a move here in Massachusetts to follow suit, and we want to talk about all that. So for more, we're joined first by Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. He's also president of the Massachusetts Sheriff's Association. Sheriff Tompkins, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you so very much. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Now, a number of our listeners probably didn't know that it cost to make a phone call in the first place. You've now moved with other sheriffs to make the first 10 minutes of calls a week free. Why did you do that, and why 10 minutes?
You know, the COVID-19 experience really opened a lot of eyes on a lot of issues. And so we just felt that insofar as trying to keep families and communities connected, and we'd gotten a lot of discussion with community leaders, legislators, and others about the cost of telephone calls, we decided that the best or most prudent thing to do was to lower the cost, to make a number of the calls free, and then after that, there would be a 14-cent charge. And if folk are wondering why there's a 14-cent charge, it's because we have a telephone vendor that basically does all of our internal infrastructure to make the telephone calls externally possible. And so, as you know, with any business, they're not going to do it for free, but they did agree to work with us to drop the cost down pretty significantly, frankly.
And the money that you collect, is it geared? Do you calibrate it to just cover the costs of the fees from the phone service?
Well, by law, we have to use monies that come in from that for inmate benefits, inmate programming. And so whatever money's left over goes towards inmate benefits and inmate programming. Now, clearly, we're going to have to work with the legislators to see if, in fact, they will help us and give us some relief on that, because programming is crucially important. I mean, what is that saying? The idle mind is the devil's playground, and we would rather not have men and women just sitting around. We want them to do programming. We want to help them improve their station in life. But that costs money also. So we're going to have to talk to the legislators. And the legislators were also very insistent on the fact that we needed to reduce costs. And so we were able to work with a number of legislators to say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And to this point, they seem to be pretty okay with that. We haven't gotten to that discussion about, are you folk going to help us out now with additional funding for programming? So we'll see where that goes.
There are two things I want to ask you based on what you just said. The first is, you can imagine that there would be those who would say people are already incarcerated. They can't earn money. They don't have jobs. Now they're being billed for being able to be in contact with their family. Any ethical concerns about having people pay and then using that money, basically the inmates not only paying to talk to their families, but having to pay for their own programming?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand your question. They're not paying for their own. Well, I guess in a certain respect, they are paying for the programming. Do I have an ethical problem with it? No, I don't have an ethical problem with it, because it costs money to do this. It costs money to have the telephone infrastructure made available so that they can reach their families and friends. And so that cost has to be paid somehow. Now, we have dropped the cost dramatically to make it a lot easier for them to make those calls. But at the end of the day, it does cost money to provide that service.
What do you think of Connecticut's move to make calls entirely free for all those who are incarcerated?
I think it's great. You know, if we could do it entirely free, we probably would here. And, you know, maybe that will come to fruition down the road. But anything that can be done to make the situation of people that are incarcerated better, I think that's a good thing, frankly. What I would like to see here in the Commonwealth, in addition to the reduction of cost in for telephone calls, is that legislators put more money on the street, so to speak, for more mental health and substance abuse beds, which we desperately need. So we're working with legislators to see how we can offer the best services to the people that are in our care and custody. But in response to your question about Connecticut, I think it's a fantastic thing.
So, you know, I do want to ask you, the population of people incarcerated in Massachusetts prisons and jails has been on a decline since 2011.
Yes.
There's a 2017 Mass Inc. study that found that correctional spending in the state, though, has increased $181 million over 5 years of that period. So are we allocating correctly now? Is there a way to free funds elsewhere that would pay for this kind of programming so the calls could be free like Connecticut's doing?
Yes. Don't send as many people to jail. And I don't mean to sound flippant, but we have far too many people in our custody that have a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. And frankly, I don't think a lot of these people should be in jail, to tell you the God's honest truth. But if someone is mentally challenged or if they're trying to feed a substance abuse habit, and they're going to do something wrong, like, say, break the law, they wind up in jail. I'm not sure that that's the best place for them. In fact, let me take that back. I am sure that that's not the best place for them. Now, can we help them? Can we deal with their situation? Sure. On the county level, guys are with us for an average of 14 months, ladies an average of 9 months. So they're not going to be with us a very long time. But I go back to the fact that I think there needs to be more resources outside of an incarceration facility so that people can get the care that they need and not be incarcerated.
And that is Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. Sheriff Tompkins, I appreciate you making some time for us. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye now.
So we turn now to State Representative China Tyler. Tyler represents Roxbury, is chair of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, and is the sponsor of a bill that would follow Connecticut's lead and make all calls from Massachusetts prisons and jails free. Representative Tyler, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. Good afternoon.
So you just heard Sheriff Tompkins say that he thinks what Connecticut has done is fantastic. So do you see a clear path forward for passage of the bill that you're sponsoring here in the Commonwealth?
So, yes, as a former corrections employee, I was honored to dedicate my career helping inmates narrow release, secure housing, employment, and community support. And one of the most common concerns was that they did not feel supported while incarcerated. And ultimately, a lot of them led to reoffend. Now, we know that given their circumstances, the most efficient way incarcerated individuals are able to connect with their support systems is by telephone. So our correction system, by default, creates financial burdens by continuing to impose increased fees on families who are highly likely to be low income. So about this bill, to be specific, in 2017, I first filed this legislation in an effort to make telephone calls more feasible for those who are incarcerated in efforts to give them the support they need while they're on their journey to be rehabilitated. So House Bill 900 is an act relative to telephone services for all inmates and correctional services in all penal institutions in the Commonwealth would essentially eliminate the cost that incarcerated individuals are required to pay per minute for these telephone calls.
I do have some questions I need to get in with you while we've got the time here. The sheriffs have taken a move here. Now, that's the jails. The sheriffs have taken a move to make the first 10 minutes free and cap, and there was variability before this, but to cap the minute-by-minute cost at 14 cents after that. Why is that not far enough? That seems like a chunk of a step in the right direction. Why is this bill necessary even after that move by the sheriffs?
Well, when we originally filed this legislation in 2017, our coalition knew exactly what we were asking and to whom we were asking it to. So as of this week, the 14 sheriffs that serve and protect our incarcerated population throughout the Commonwealth are now partners in this initiative towards equity. So we welcome their continued leadership on this issue and hope to enlist more support of this legislation and other policies that will help simply keep families together and make sure that our Commonwealth is safe.
So, you know, we heard Sheriff Tompkins support the move in Connecticut. He's the head of an organization that obviously worked in partnership with you. There have been other sheriffs like Bristol County Sheriff Hodgson who have made the point, for example, to Commonwealth Magazine last year, The jail's a place of punishment and correction. Fees are part of the deal. If you don't want to pay the fees, don't be incarcerated. What is your response to that kind of criticism of this approach?
That's a good question. Well, when an individual is incarcerated, it not only changes their life immediately, it impacts their family and loved ones as well. And there are strong data that shows that the pandemic has greatly impacted the financial well-being of families throughout the Commonwealth, especially those experiencing incarceration. So with limited resources, communication, especially at this time and going forward, should be a right, not a privilege. And this legislation just simply is about keeping families together. In 2016 to 2018, State Auditor Suzanne Bump conducted a performance audit of certain activities of the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department. And one of the objectives of her audit was to see if the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department properly administered its revenue and its contracting process for goods and services. And the conclusion of that objective was that they did not do so. So in efforts to ensure that our correction systems are places of rehabilitation, which includes equitable communication contracts with telephone service providers, pushing to ensure free phone calls is an obvious step in the right direction.
Now, we don't obviously still have Suffolk County Sheriff Tompkins on the line to respond to those charges. I do want to note that. I think this is the other thing that I want to ask you, Representative Tyler. So Sheriff Tompkins talks about the fact that the revenues from phone calls go to supportive programming for inmates. Yeah. The bill that you're putting forward would take away those revenues and provide a benefit to the inmates. But then what steps do we need to take for the supportive services that were funded in the millions of dollars by the revenue from the phone calls? I mean, there's a math problem there. How do you solve that?
Yeah, so long story short, being incarcerated is expensive. And currently, incarcerated individuals are required to have money in their accounts to pay for anything from food to clothing to toiletries to sanitation products. And out of the same bank account, their same budget, they're also expected to fund their permanent cost of telephone calls. So with some correctional facilities across the Commonwealth charging as high as 40 cents at one point per minute for these calls, it becomes next to impossible for those incarcerated to ultimately stay connected to their support systems. So for me, as an individual outside of those walls, that would be almost a $500 a month cell phone bill. And that's just unrealistic. Their accounts go ahead.
So then in our remaining time, I'll invite you to finish the point you were going to make and then also just tell us what are the next steps on this legislation. Please go ahead.
Excellent. Thank you for that. So their accounts are often funded by occupations that they have while incarcerated, which only really generates from $5 to $35 a week. So typically the majority of their funds come from their family and network outside of the prison. So this legislation would ease a significant part of the financial burden on their families. And the bottom line is that we must stop the correction system from further deepening impoverishment of incarcerated individuals and their families. So, and as far as next steps you can take, I would definitely encourage you all to come to the legislature to share your piece and to share your thoughts and ideas and solutions on this issue topic. This bill is being currently considered before the House of Representatives and the Senate. It is House Bill 1900, and it is in the Judiciary Committee, and we look forward to hearing this this bill in the near future.
All right. State Representative Chyna Tyler represents Roxbury and is chair of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus. Thanks, Representative, for being here.
Thank you.
State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz made it official this week. She is running for governor. She joins two others in their quest for the Democratic nomination. All the while, Governor Baker himself has not yet said if he'll seek re-election. If he does, it would be an unprecedented third term he'd be going for. Now, it might seem early, but this race is getting interesting, even all these months ahead, and there's a lot to unpack. So we want to do that. Here to help us sort it all through is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks and from the Boston Globe, Kimberly Atkins Storr. She's a senior opinion writer there. Anthony, Kimberly, welcome.
Hi there.
Great to have you both. So, Anthony, I know you talked with State Senator Chang Diaz. Tell us a little bit about her and the significance of her entering the race.
Right. So she jumped in yesterday, jumping into what's becoming a pretty diverse field of Democratic candidates. She is a former teacher. She's the daughter of a social worker and an immigrant who became the first Latino astronaut, which I think is an interesting detail about her backstory. She was the first Latina elected to the state Senate. She's the only woman of color currently serving in the Senate, where she's garnered a reputation as something of a progressive. She was one of the chief sponsors of education reform legislation that sought to make school funding fairer for low-income and special ed students. She was also a co-sponsor of criminal justice reform. And yesterday, she traveled from Springfield to Worcester and then to Jamaica Plain to kick off her candidacy. And it was a bit of a trip that highlighted working people to make the points that she wanted to make, a kind of working people's tour of Massachusetts, if you will. For example, when I caught up with her, it was in Worcester. She met with nurses at St. Vincent Hospital who have been on strike since March over staffing levels. And then on to Jamaica Plain to make her announcement that she was jumping in the race for governor.
So, Kimberly, she is clearly a progressive candidate. We're talking about the Democratic primary here because no one yet knows for sure what Governor Baker is going to do. Is this the year or the years, given that their election isn't until next year, of the progressive in this governor's race?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, we know that governor's races in Massachusetts are always so different from other statewide races. So while last year the big U.S. Senate contest between Joe Kennedy and Ed Markey really turned on Ed Markey fortifying his progressive bona fides, which helped him to win, people in Massachusetts like to elect a divided government in the state. I mean, in my lifetime, there's only been two Democratic governors in the state of Massachusetts. So being the most progressive Democrat isn't necessarily going to win you the primary, let alone win you the final seat. So we'll have to see who else jumps in. I'm keeping my eye on, really, to see if Maura Healey jumps in, which will really shake up the race in terms of both fundraising and also just this sort of national profile she's built, as opposed to the very local, state-focused approach that Sonia Cheng Diaz is taking.
I do want to pick up on Maura Healey in just a second. Before I do, one other sort of this general question about where we are, Anthony. Multiple Democrats in the race. It's June of 2021. I almost had to check my calendar because times just have no meaning anymore. And the race isn't really, you know, the election's not till next year. So is this early for this many people to be jumping in? And if so, why?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it would be early if we knew what the field was going to look like. I mean, Kimberly's right. The big question is, Maura Healey going to get in? We don't know if Charlie Baker is going to get in. So the race is still taking shape. But here's the thing. If you're relatively unknown across the state, like Sonia Cheng Diaz and like Ben Downing and like Danielle Allen, the three Democrats who have jumped in, if you're relatively well-known, strategists are going to tell you that you need to jump in early for a variety of reasons. So here's Democratic political strategist Marianne Marsh, who I spoke to yesterday.
Well, I think unless your name is Charlie Baker or Maura Healey, you have to get in early. You need the time to build up your name recognition, to build an organization, to raise money, to be competitive in a primary, let alone a general election if you get nominated. So for the people in the race now, they all need to be in the race now.
Yeah, and I think, Tiziana, her point about Charlie Baker and Maura Healey, if you're not one of those two, you really need to get in early. So here we are. The race is underway.
Okay, so Kimberly, somebody is Maura Healey. You talked about whether or not she's going to get in. And what is the AG likely looking at? And does Sonia Cheng Diaz entering the race change her calculus at all? What do you think her calculus is? She's been really good at not answering those questions when asked of late.
Yes, she and most people in Massachusetts, where folks like Anthony and me, it's our job literally to ask them what office they're going to run for next. It remains to be seen. I mean, one thing that Maura Healey would have jumping in whenever she at this point anyway is a big fundraising advantage. She also has name recognition, and she also has, as I talked about before, this sort of national reputation as somebody who really really went after Donald Trump and sued him countless times in his administration over those policies. So that's really how she's burnished her name while in office. It's up to if that's the office she wants to seek and run for, if she sees the governorship as the logical next step or something else. And I think it also will depend on what Charlie Baker will do. I mean, if he seems ready to run for re-election, he's still fairly popular there in the state, it may be worth saving that money and that time and looking at another office down the road. But it's still so many unknowns at play right now. And I agree with Anthony, for everyone else in this race, it's important for them to get in early, whereas I think both Maura Healey and Charlie Baker have a little time to think about this.
So, Anthony, let's stay on Maura Healey. Kimberly just talked about sort of her track record, for example, suing President Trump. We know she's fought Purdue Pharma. But there are some on in Democratic circles who don't think she's progressive enough, call her out on her commitment to racial justice, police reform. Is she exposed on the left in this race?
Well, I mean, I think if she did jump in, she would certainly have to answer questions from these candidates who perhaps want to run in the progressive lane and will do everything they can to sort of hold on to that lane. So for sure, she's going to have to answer those questions. I think in general, you know, when you've been an office holder and you have a record, especially as a prosecutor and an attorney general like Maura Healey, it's natural that you're going to be exposed to those questions on the left. But as Kimberly mentioned, she also has a pretty strong record as running, you know, suing the Trump administration and really staking out that territory as, you know, a pretty well-established liberal, if not progressive, Democrat. So I think she'd do okay making that case, even if she did have to take some fire on those issues.
Okay, so you've both made it clear that the big question right now is, will Charlie Baker run? We know, we've covered here on Radio Boston a lot over the last few months, the disgruntled nature of the Republican Party in the Commonwealth and the fact that the Republican base don't necessarily hold for him, but we also know how popular he is in general and among Democrats. I'm just going to ask you, both of you, do you think he's going to run again?
I'm
Anthony,
laughing because Kimberly, you know, I'll go out on a limb. I think he's going to run, but I don't say that with any kind of insider knowledge. I don't say that because I've spoken sources close to Baker say. I just have a gut feeling that I can't imagine what else Charlie Baker would do, frankly. And he's got a strong record. He's got a pile of money. He can raise more money in an instant. And yeah, I think he's going to run, but it's just a gut feeling that I have.
What about you, Kimberly?
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, in the Trumpified GOP world, there aren't a lot of places for the Charlie Bakers to go if they want to stay in politics. And it seems that the best job he could possibly run for is the one that he already has.
And can he win?
I think that's true. I mean, there's... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Jump in. I'm interested. Go.
No, I was just going to say, you know, there's rumors that, you know, could he even run for president, for example, as a sort of sane, moderate Republican who could attract independents. But I just don't see Charlie Baker doing that. I just don't see that he has that appetite for that kind of thing. I can't imagine him wanting to go through the kind of gauntlet of New Hampshire and Iowa primaries in South Carolina. He just hasn't been that kind of politician. He's been focused on the details of governing, and he does it, you know, pretty well. And I think that's where his comfort level is.
All right. So I'm going to enlist both of your help now, because I find this stuff fascinating, right? We're a year and a half out, but I think it's riveting. This is a huge race, it seems to me, this next race for governor in the Commonwealth. But a lot of people don't pay attention yet. And I want to know, just like when I work with Check the Score with Chris Sitterick and we help non-sports fans, you know, learn how to follow sports, who help people figure out what's fun to follow and interesting to follow right now as this race emerges. And Kimberly, you chuckled first, so you get to go first.
Well, there are just such interesting people who are already in the mix. I mean, you have Danielle Allen, who's sort of coming, it seems, almost out of nowhere to blaze this trail. You have Sonia Cheng Diaz, who's been around for a long time. She was there when I covered the State House, I won't say how many years ago, and has been working to burnish her her credentials and working her way, focusing on that progressive agenda. It's just going to be a fun race. It's going to take a long time because people have a lot of money to raise. They have their name recognition to boost up. And look, the Massachusetts gubernatorial race is a big one. Just think about how many presidential campaigns have come from, Massachusetts gubernatorial races and other things. This is a big deal, not just on the local stage, but on the national one. So the fact that it's getting started so early is not really surprising to me. Folks here are going to be watching it here in Washington, D.C., where I am. It's a big deal. I think it's going to be naturally fun to watch anyway. So I don't think there's any particular thing that we need to point out. I just think that anybody interested in politics is going to, learn a lot watching this race.
Yeah, and Anthony, will that be good for the Commonwealth? You know, I guess my bias is that a hotly contested election is good for democracy. Do you see something unfolding here that is good for the issues, is good for combing out what needs to happen in the Commonwealth post-pandemic? Will this bring things to light that we need to make decisions on?
Oh, I think so. I mean, obviously I'm biased in answering this question because I care about this stuff passionately. It's what I do. But look, there's a big moment possibly coming for Massachusetts. I mean, there's this big showdown for governor along with this fight for the soul and the identity of the Massachusetts Republican Party. There's possibly going to be an open seat for attorney general if Maura Healey decides to run for governor. For state treasurer, there's an historic election for mayor of Boston, which will result in the first mayor who is not a white man in more than 200 years. I mean, so all this is a sign of the times, of a reevaluation, of coming to terms with racial inequality. And the result is a potential sea change in the politics around here. And I think it's extremely exciting and important. Mm-hmm. And stay tuned. There's a lot to hold on to here and to take a measure of.
Well, you guys have got my pulse racing. I love this stuff. And this is a great start. I'm looking forward to talking to you more as we go along. We just heard Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter, and also Kimberly Atkins-Storr, a senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you for helping us kick it off today.
Thanks.
Hey, my pleasure.
School is out. Summer is here. But there is so much work to do. There are preparations for what will hopefully be the first normal return to school since the pandemic started. There's the work of helping kids overcome learning loss, trauma, mental health strains from the last 15 months. And if you're Brenda Caselius, the head of the Boston Public Schools, there are also a number of institutional challenges that have to be addressed. Superintendent Caselius has checked in with us throughout the pandemic. We're happy to close the school year with her today. Superintendent Caselius, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
And thank you, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
So school year has come to an end. I'm going to ask you, did you crawl over the finish line or are you still on your 2 feet?
Well, actually, I think we celebrated over the finish line because we were able to work with the Red Sox and have our graduations at Fenway, which was such a celebratory end to what was a really challenging and difficult school year. And to see our graduates come across the stage after all that they've persevered, with diplomas in hand and their teachers cheering them on. It was quite an amazing moment.
So I there's a lot we're going to talk about, but I just kind of want to dig into the heart of this year's experience. When you look back at it, what are you at peace with and what aren't you at peace with over how things unfolded over this last school year?
What I am at peace with is that our team really rallied and the community really rallied, the city, everybody, it was an all hands on deck. And we couldn't have done it with all the incredible support of our families who bridged the gap and helped lift us up and help keep their kids engaged, to our teachers who got creative and just, launched into a one-to-one platform and reinvented their practice. To our school leaders who just, had to continue to shift and change with the shifting and changing guidance that we had in our operational team and, just really, really getting it done for kids and really the toughest of circumstances of a global pandemic. And so that's what I'm at peace with. I think the thing that I'm not at peace with is that we really did, have a hard time engaging our older students, especially. Our younger students had a difficult time, our 3, 4, 5-year-olds accessing the technology, and then some of our parents just really not knowing how to help their students, especially parents who had language barriers. So those are things that we've learned and we'll take into account as we start the new year, and we'll get stronger because of it.
So knowing that now, and none of us can go back. I mean, over my career, I know there are many times where I knew then, right, what I know now. If you did know then what you know now, is there anything you would have done differently last September in setting up that 2020 to 2021 school year?
Well, it was really hard to know back then because we just didn't know what we were dealing with still within, you know, August, September. You know, one of the things I think that we began to get more evidence and science behind was the air quality. And I wish, you know, our buildings just weren't so old and that our windows were fixed and that we had better systems and better science behind air quality. I think that was one of the things that was tripping us up the most was how are we going to ensure the health and safety of our teachers, of our students, of our whole school community with the air quality. So lots to learn there. Good thing the Harvard professors stepped in and gave us good guidance on that.
So let's talk about this summer now. You know, one of the things that I know has come up is this balance between the need to aid young people, kids who may have lost learning over the last year. You just talked about the kids that you're not at peace with because they struggled, the younger kids, the high school kids who didn't check in as often, where there wasn't family support or there wasn't internet access. And there's work to be done there. And we've also heard, we did a segment recently here on Radio Boston where there was a child psychiatrist talking about the need for kids to just be kids this summer. You know, what that balance and how do we make the call between summer school, summer programs, and break out of the building and play?
Yes. Well, play is extremely important to learning. And I'm real big on play-based learning, project-based learning, you know, expeditionary learning. And Boston really has great programming, nationally recognized programming with Boston After School and Beyond. We have been partnering with them for many years now. I was just pleased when I came into Boston 2 years ago and found this program already enriching the lives of our children during the summer gap months. But this year in particular, being very intentional around the trauma, we have additional nurses and social workers who will be working with our students so that we reconnect with them and rebuild and help our students kind of re-enter into the space of learning. At the same time, also being cognizant of outdoor play, outdoor spaces, outdoor gardening, there's sailing classes, arts programming, and then connecting with the city on city jobs for our older kids to get them back out and engaged. So a lot of options for families as we reconnect and reengage this summer.
So, you know, we've been talking about this unprecedented year. There are a number of institutional challenges for the Boston Public Schools right now, too. And I want to dive into some of those with you. And I want to start with this idea of a virtual school. A week ago, you announced that Boston Public Schools would reverse course and not open a virtual school this fall. You said it was too short of a timeline. What would have made a difference here? For example, if the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education had given you feedback sooner, and your final application could have been in what, beginning of June, would that have helped? What would have allowed you to do the virtual school this year?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's part of it is, you know, just getting the application and getting the green light sooner would have helped. And I think also just the fact of having to go back to school this fall and reconnect and get families engaged again was another piece of it. Registration, we've had late registrations. And so how would we get families? And there wasn't a lot of interest. We had less than 1,000 families express interest into a BPS virtual school, which then made us think, well, maybe there are other options that we could work with families. And we know that our families sometimes will make decisions a little later to around school choice. And so we thought even that 1,000 number might not hold up once they start reemerging after being shut in or maybe unvaccinated, and now they'll get vaccinated. So we didn't think that it was really going to be viable to establish the entire BPS virtual school. So we'll be working over the summer to see if we can do a smaller program for instructional opportunities for students who need to be at least part-time remote.
But it is my understanding that you plan to open a virtual school for the fall of 2022. Is that correct?
We're going to explore that as a possibility to open for fall of 2022 if we think that there's greater interest.
So I wonder, I understand it's fewer than 1,000 people. I also understand there's so much that kids couldn't have and schools couldn't do. And I got to ask you, is it hard? You were going to do this or thought you were. Is it hard to say no to something you could have done that you were going to do at a time when there's so much in the last 15 or 16 months schools couldn't do for kids and families, even small groups, if they wanted it?
Yeah, we always wish that we could offer a full menu of programming and services to our families, and we'll continue to strive to do that. And we just, you know, in this short of time of period, we just were not able to do that. And if it's possible to get one up and going, even in a smaller sense, in the next several years, we're going to continue to explore it, especially since our kids are now one-to-one. And there are great ways to do blended learning and to have classrooms without walls, you know, and find ways, especially at the upper school level, to be able to have kids take courses online and through remote options, you know, that aren't necessarily in a brick and mortar classroom.
Okay, I want to turn to the Boston School Committee. Most recently, two resignations, but over the last, well, a little less than a year, four resignations total, including two chairs of the school committee. Your assessment of the state of the Boston School Committee right now and how to repair the damage after the loss of so many committee members, mostly around racial tensions, although we'll get to the student representative in that issue as well.
You know, so obviously it's painful and challenging for the community to have turnover on your school committee. But I, you know, we have five seasoned school committee members now who are working together. They elected a chair within Ms. Jerry Robinson, who is a known leader within the community around early childhood. And, you know, she's been on the committee for several years. And then Michael O'Neill, who is the vice chair, will be still continuing to be the vice chair and supporting her. We meet weekly, you know, once or twice a week. And we talk about the issues of the school district. And so I feel it's in a strong position, and the mayor's made a commitment to have those seats filled within the next several weeks here.
Okay, so the Boston Public Schools are due about $430 million in elementary and secondary school emergency relief, or ESSER. That's funding coming from the federal government. The school committee ultimately votes on how to spend it. And then State Education Commissioner Jeff Riley has threatened to freeze, or said he's considering freezing this funding as a result of the turmoil in the school committee. Here he is speaking during a Tuesday Department of Elementary and Secondary Education virtual meeting.
I am extremely concerned about what's transpired on that school committee. They've lost four members this year, two of whom are board chairs. And the fact that there's nearly $500 million, I think it's $430 million that are coming in ESSER funding, makes me nervous about what's happening in Boston. And so we're going to wait and see and look at the stability and what happens with that board.
First, your response to that, and also, have you spoken with the commissioner since he made those remarks?
I have spoken to the commissioner, and I know that he was responding to one of his school committee members and, you know, trying to put in context, you know, how disruptive it can be. However, you know, I speak to the commissioner quite regularly because of our MOU. And, you know, I think that, you know, we are going to have a strong plan. We've had a very strong stakeholder engagement process with our commission. We've had a number of community meetings. We've met with our parent groups. We've met with our school leaders. We've met with the BTU and union leaders. And so we have really strong input into this plan, which, you know, is what a school committee does. And so when I bring the recommendations to the school committee, they will be very well vetted and I think broad consensus around the areas in which to invest that funding. And we've also we're working to put in an oversight office within the Boston Public Schools so that we're good stewards of the funding and make sure that we hold ourselves accountable for the implementation and monitoring of that funding. And so I think that that will give him confidence in being able to release those dollars. Obviously, you know, this is the this funding is put in place for recovery, and we need to get that in the hands of our teachers and our school leaders as soon as possible so that they can do the good work on behalf of our kids.
Okay, so there's more we could talk about there, but I'm aware of time and there's some other issues I want to jump into. With the school committee in mind, it's considering doing away with the entrance exams for elite schools like Boston Latin School, Boston Latin Academy, the O'Brien School of Math and Science, replacing that with a lottery. You and I talked on air when the exam was temporarily suspended due to COVID. You know, the goal would be to help level the playing field by giving students who are economically or academically disadvantaged an equal shot. This would be a seismic shift for the school district, for families. What's the path to a quality decision there? And what information and factors do you think need to be considered?
Well, first, I want to thank, you know, the co-chairs, Tanisha Sullivan, president of the NAACP, and Mike Contopassis, longtime educator, head of school at the Boston Latin School, as well as superintendent of Boston Public Schools, and their incredible work of working with this entire working group to look at all of the different options, looking at grading, looking at the use of an assessment, looking at geographic equity, lotteries, census tracts, zip codes, and how that data all shakes out. And so just very appreciative of the many, many hours they've put in and the community engagement that they've done. We met with city council members, we met with electeds at the State House, we've met with parents and broad-based community members around those options. They're meeting again this evening. I anticipate that they're getting closer to consensus to bring recommendations. And we hope to be having those next Wednesday at the school committee meeting.
And is the lottery the best way to achieve equity?
Well, they have, they're debating the lottery, they're debating zip code, and they're debating the kind of the qualifying pool to get in terms of merit. And so those are what the group is still debating in terms of how to get best at equity. As you know, this year we were able to pilot a program and we did get at greater equity. We had more students who were homeless who, you know, maybe wouldn't have had a shot before, students who speak languages other than English. We had racial diversity. We had more diversity with students with disabilities who were able to access our exam schools. And so it's, you know, I'm really excited about the opportunity to bring greater equity and geographic equity across the city to our exam schools.
All right. I want to talk about Youth on Board. I want to talk about the controversy over their use of reevaluation counseling with the District Student Advisory Council. This is a complex story. We're not going to break it all down here. A recent investigation found concerns with the reevaluation counseling. A number of students resigned and concerned about it. BPS announced last month that you are expanding this investigation. Any updates on that investigation, and when do you expect it to conclude?
Yeah, this is really just an unfortunate, you know, two-decade program that was going on with our students around peer counseling and reevaluation counseling that we had no idea about, and I had no idea about, but we need to get to the bottom of that. And that is why I expanded the investigation to look at former students and look broader within the organization and what went wrong here and get to the bottom of it. And, you know, we have now hired an outside investigator who will do that work. And we're just finalizing our contract with that person and we will get started on that right away.
I have to ask you this tough question. You know, some students have called for you to resign as a result of this. You just said you didn't know about it. Should you have known about it?
Well, for the past 18 months, I've been doing a pandemic, but I have been meeting with the students. And so, you know, I wish that I had known from them. You know, I met with them almost weekly during the pandemic, really early shut-in days, and then went to once a month meeting with them. And, you know, students are my heart. And that's the reason I come to this work and come to this job. And so when I learned of it, we swiftly dealt with it. We ended our relationship immediately. We expanded the investigation. And, you know, we are now doing the really hard work of repair with our students. We created new bylaws with them, and we are moving forward and trying to deal with the healing that unfortunately, the trust that was broken with our students. And, that's the best that you can do moving forward is, you know, make sure that we own what is our responsibility and that we are able to move forward and make it right.
All right. So much for us to talk about. I do hope you'll come back again soon. Before we let you go, what are you going to do to blow off some steam this summer?
Water ski. And, nice. and read a couple of good books.
Nice. Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Casilius, thanks for closing the school year with us.
Thank you, Tiziana. I appreciate you.
So Boston Public Schools conversation there. We're going to turn now to WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, who was listening. Max, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Max, we have just a little bit of time, and what I really want to know are your reactions to what we just heard from the superintendent.
Tiziana, in these long interviews with Casilius, I'm always reminded that her roots are in Minnesota. She has to be one of the most upbeat public officials in this state, even after like the most grinding 16 months you can imagine. But I do think you heard that she recognizes that there is, as you said, a lot of work to do for the district on a ton of different fronts. So it just has to be daunting.
And you've been following, we talked about a lot of different things. The one I really want to ask you about is you've been following this threat from Commissioner Riley on the ESSER funds to Boston Public Schools. Are those reasonable consequences for a failure in leadership? Is that a power move? What would be the consequences if he withholds that funding?
Well, Tiziana, I spoke to a teacher who serves on the nominating committee for new members of the school committee, and he made a good point. He said he had three members resign after making comments that in some way damaged public trust. Is that a failure? You know, if they resigned and then taking a month to find their replacements, is that a failure? I think that's a reasonable argument. It kind of got lost in the shuffle last spring that the state was kind of edging its way into BPS in an oversight role due to perceived academic underperformance. And I do think we're kind of getting some reminders lately that Commissioner Jeff Riley hasn't forgotten about Boston. Just as a final thought on the consequences, it may not seem like a big deal if you have to go, say, 3 or 4 weeks without these funds being released. But, you know, people in the education budget business say June and July are important months. That's when you have the best hires to make out of the labor market. New programs take a little while to plan, like that virtual academy. And then you've got works projects that are urgent and time consuming, and you want to get those underway.
Max, we are actually at the end of the show. I'm glad we got to touch bases with you a little bit, and I hope you'll come back soon because I think there's more we should talk about here.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Yep, that's WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. And folks, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beland. We have help from Ali Audette, Stephen Gelman, and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And I am Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow, because tomorrow is Radio Boston's Week in Review.